Hi, I'm Greg Moores, and welcome to the Life Camp Show, where you'll get practical tools for living life using quantum physics principles. You ever wonder why you never really learned the things in school, like how to make a lot of money, how to have fantastic relationships, how to create meaningful, fulfilling experiences at will? Well, the reason is that school basically has an agenda. They have a specific purpose in mind. They want you to learn how to get a job. Because if you look at where schools are funded, they're funded by corporations. Corporations fund schools so that the people that graduate from school will know how to get out and get a better job. If the people that funded the schools taught you how to make a lot of money, then you wouldn't have a reason to go get a job working for them. So they have a vested interest in making sure that you learn reading, writing, and arithmetic, which are skills that are great for getting a job, but that you don't learn how to have fantastic relationships, how to make a whole lot of money, and how to create amazing experiences at will. So today we're going to talk a little bit about how to do those specific things. I'd like to start by talking about a quantum physics principle very closely related to gravity. It's a force I call evolity. Do you ever wonder why you yearn? Like, you know, we go through life and all of a sudden we find ourselves yearning, like I want more out of life. And it seems like no matter who we are, we still yearn for more. Do you know anyone that doesn't want more in life? Think about it for a minute. See if you can think of anyone on this planet that does not want more in life. Even if they're a multi-billionaire, everyone on this planet is yearning for more. And the reason is because we live in a field, it's like a force field, that literally makes our molecules yearn to become better at who we are. Just like we live in a field of gravity. I'm sitting here in this chair, and gravity is pulling me down into the chair. That force of gravity pulls on my mass, and it gives me weight. So gravitation pulls on my mass to give me weight. There's another force similar to gravity. It may actually be related to it, and I'll call that force evolity. And here's what that force is like. It's another field we live in. It pulls on any living cell and makes it yearn for evolution. Just like gravity pulls on cells with mass, evolity pulls on living cells. Just like gravity creates this pull to the center of the Earth, evolity creates a pull in us to evolve and become better at what we are. Think about it. Rocks don't get much better at being rocks. They pretty much stay the same. But a tree, a lizard, human beings, they yearn to become better at becoming what they are. Rocks don't experience fear. They don't experience excitement. But a tree, a lizard, these creatures that are, you know, mammals, human beings, the more evolved we become, the more we experience a yearning to become more evolved. So we literally live in a field of evolution that drives us crazy on the cellular level. Even a single-celled amoeba gets better at being what it is. So you're not crazy because you want a better job. The fact is that 80% of America's workforce says they would rather have another job. They would rather have a more rewarding career. The reason you yearn for that is not just because you're not happy with what you have. And we hear this thing, you know, people say, well, you know, you should be grateful for what you have. You can't. You're living in a field of evolity. It is literally driving you crazy, making you yearn to want more. So how do we answer that call? Well, you answer the call by actually becoming better at being who you are. And to do this, we've got to take a look at what is most meaningful to me. And let's take a look at the quantum physics principle where I tend to project my values and what's most meaningful to me onto other things. I have a pen here. And if I were to ask you, what is this pen worth? You would probably say maybe a dollar, maybe $2. But if I asked 10 different people what this pen was worth, I'd get 10 different answers. Somebody might say, I'd pay a quarter for that. Somebody might say, well, that looks like a nice pen. I'll pay $10 for it. So here's my question. Does the value actually exist in the pen? Or is the value of the pen actually sitting right here in the chair? We all agree that this is a piece of black plastic. But the value of the pen, we project onto the pen from inside us. Now, perhaps you've met people that you don't like. You know, you meet somebody, you haven't even really talked to them much, but you don't like them. And you project it's a mean person, it's a nasty person. Or you have people in your life that you just don't trust. Or you have people in your life that make you angry, make you frustrated. or people that make you feel like a fool. And the exact same thing is true. And here's my statement. When we feel like we don't trust someone, is it true that we don't trust them, or is it true that we don't trust ourselves when we're with them? In other words, if I don't trust somebody, is it really that I don't trust them, or is it that I don't trust that I can take care of myself when I'm around that person? So I feel uncomfortable with me around them. I believe that everyone we meet, we are actually projecting what's meaningful onto them and then pretending that those are qualities that have to do with them. And I'll prove it. If I was uncomfortable and I said I don't really trust someone for any reason, and I went out and became the master of martial arts, and I knew that I could manifest fantastic boundaries so that I could ask for what I want and acknowledge what I want, and when people cross my boundaries, I know how to stand up for myself, and I feel totally comfortable with me wherever I go, then I wouldn't feel like I don't trust this person, would I? Then I would know that if this person ever did something that might challenge me, that I'm up for the challenge, and so I don't have a reason to mistrust them. And this is what we do all day. We meet people that talk about other people like they don't trust them, and they screwed them, and they have all kinds of problems, or they're an angry person. And the fact is, what we hate about angry people is that we don't know how to be appropriate around angry people. The other day I was in a supermarket, and there was a woman there, and she was berating her child in a really uncomfortable way. And I noticed that the woman in front of me shook her head and kind of turned away from the incident. And I got out of line, and I walked over to the woman, and I said, "Excuse me. I really want you to treat that child with respect." And she looked up at me, somewhat surprised, and I said, "It really is unacceptable to be berating your child in public. Please treat the child with respect." And she looked at me and said, "This is none of your business." And I said, "Excuse me, in your living room, this is none of my business. Here in the supermarket, if I have to watch that, it's my business." And she looked at me a little bit stunned, didn't know quite what to say, took her child by the hand and walked out and left her shopping cart full of groceries there. And I got back in line to purchase my groceries, and I had a couple people looking at me like, "Wow, that's pretty impressive." And I felt really good walking out of the supermarket because, you know, so many times I've turned my back on those people pretending, you know, "Well, it's none of my business." If you're in any situation that's really uncomfortable for you, and because of this force of evolvity, you will want to improve that situation on some level. The question is, do you have the skill set? So what we're here to provide today is the skills so that you can actually ask for what you really want, acknowledge your boundaries, and take a stand for what's most meaningful to you. Let me give you another scenario. We as people tend to think, gosh, you know, I'd really like to improve. Because we have this yearning for evolution, we're thinking, boy, I'd really like to improve. And we get a vision of who we are. It kind of floats above our head. A vision that's like, I'd like to be a guy that has more money. Or I'd like to be a guy that has a nicer home. Or I'd like to be a guy that can really, you know, do courageous things. Make a difference in people's lives. So I create this vision of myself. I'm at point A, sitting in the chair, and the vision of myself at point B some year, a few months down the road. And then what I do is I basically create all kinds of little X steps and activities to help me become the man that I'm yearning to be. So I'm trying to get from point A to point B. This is a Newtonian principle. When Isaac Newton discovered gravity because the apple fell, he discovered a linear physics where he could figure out if things are traveling in a straight line that they'll keep traveling and he'll figure out when they arrive someplace. It's a very linear line. And we as people for hundreds of years have been thinking in a linear context. We've been thinking, all right, you know, one day I'll get here. Or, you know, we think of our life as a timeline. I want to present to you the quantum physics model of your life. You are not on a line where you're born here and you die here. In fact, time starts looking really suspicious when we look at quantum physics. The model for how to look at your life is you are a sphere. In other words, instead of you sitting on a timeline somewhere, and it's really hard to include others when we do that because they have a timeline, and what? Their timelines intersect. Well, what happens when I get married? Do all of a sudden our timelines sort of join each other? No, it doesn't make sense. But if I think of my life as a sphere, call it a sphere of influence, if you will, what happens is I have the things that are most meaningful to me. And the yearning, the field of evolvity pulls on those things most meaningful to me and makes me want to be better in those areas. So say it's loyalty or kindness or compassion. Those are the things that I want to get better at. And so my life as a sphere means that if I actually create activities and projects that allow me to fill that sphere with what's most meaningful to me, then I'll be able to live in a world created by me that's incredibly meaningful to me. And we know some people that have done this. People like Oprah, people like Bill Gates, people like a lot of the celebrities that live in their own little world because they basically said, you know what, it's important to me to sing. So I'm going to create some songs, I'm going to write, and they really take a stand for what's most meaningful to them. And people tell them, oh, you shouldn't stick out, but they don't care because they want to live in a sphere that's incredibly meaningful to them. And we call them selfish. And the fact is we envy them. And we wish we had those skills. Those people that can create a sphere of what's most meaningful. Then there are people that allow their sphere to collapse. These are people that are going to be the people pleasers of life. People that live in mediocrity, the status quo. They allow their sphere to become so small because they're never taking a stand for what's most meaningful to them, that their sphere becomes so small that they then have to all of a sudden really fight and argue for what they really want. And any time they're around another person that has a sphere of influence, because their sphere is so small and the other person's sphere is so big, they feel manipulated. They feel like, oh, you know, they're doing things to me. And they feel threatened and fearful. And that's not because the other person has a large sphere of influence and there's something wrong with them. It's, again, because I have a sphere that's basically so small that I don't know how to really take care of myself, so I show up in other people's environments and I'm blown around like leaves in the wind. And then I blame them for having a powerful influence on my life. And the way I do that is I react with anger, or I say, you know, don't do that. Instead of actually taking a stand for what I want, making powerful requests, acknowledging my boundaries, focusing on what's most meaningful to me, not on what people did or where they came from or what they said. So we tend to project what is most valuable to us onto other people. Just like we project the value of the pen onto the pen. And then we pretend the pen actually contains value. It's a strange thing, but we actually do put a price tag on this pen. Like it might have a sticker that says 50 cents. What happens is I look at that pen, and if I value it worth 75 cents and the price tag is on the sticker says 50, I'll buy it. But if somebody else does not have a sticker and or if somebody else looks at the sticker and they think the pen is worth a dollar, they will not buy the pen because they don't see that the pen has the value that they're looking for. Does this make sense? If the price tag on the sticker is greater than the value that I project onto it, then I won't buy it. But if the price tag on the sticker is less than the value I project onto it, then I will buy it. And we do the same thing with people. But understand the source of the value and what's meaningful that we're projecting on other people is coming from us. So what this means is your eyes are not actually just receptors. They are also projectors. I'm picking up data, sure. I'm seeing the color come into me off things. But when it comes to value, I'm projecting, just like a movie projector onto a screen in a movie theater, I'm projecting onto everybody else what is most valuable to me, and then I'm judging them as if it has something to do with them. The reason quantum physics has so much to offer in this field is because quantum physics basically says you cannot separate the observer from the object observed. And this is the difference between a standard experiment in a laboratory where what I do is I take something and I look at it and I say, well, it has qualities, and I measure its qualities, and I say, all right, this is what it does, and I measure it over and over again, and I find, well, there's some small variations, but those are just anomalies. Basically, I pretend that the item itself actually has qualities and they don't change and I can't change them. What quantum physics says is that there are certain experiments that we conduct with people where the object basically changes when we look at it differently. Wayne Dyer once said this when he was talking about our intention and the power of our intention. He said, when we change the way we look at things, the things we look at change. Have you ever heard of a child who, you know, grew up in a family where he was told he was nothing, and then all of a sudden a teacher came along and said, you're something, you can make something out of your life, I believe in you. And all of a sudden that child like rose like a shining star. This is the principle of quantum physics. If we are able to look at a project or a person or a relationship and basically see that we, believing in that project and its outcome and how it can be brilliant and beautiful, and being stubborn and tenacious, can actually create the outcome that we're looking for just by holding our intention there. And these feelings of being threatened by something or that there's a problem with something going on out there are not actually coming from out there. And this is some other interesting data that we have on how the human being experiences objects out in its world. So, consider this. We know that cells are made of molecules. We know that molecules are made of atoms. Atoms are made of protons, neutrons, and electrons. And of recent, we've figured out that protons, neutrons, and electrons are made of quarks. Quarks are these small particles. They look like, sometimes they act like particles, sometimes they act like waves. They're these very small particles, smaller than electrons, and it looks like they are what makes up the electrons, protons, and neutrons. And then we know that quarks are made up of what is called strings. Now, the interesting thing about quarks is that wherever we look for quarks is where they show up. Like if I look for a molecule, as in the molecules of the pen, and I put them right here, what happens is the next time I look for them, I know they're there. Well, actually, when we start looking at quarks, we can't say that. Because what happens with quarks is when we look away from them, they don't necessarily exist where we left them. They exist everywhere. Possibly they exist everywhere because quarks are constantly appearing and disappearing. And then when we look for a quark, that's when we actually see it. And we've actually been able to prove this in laboratories, that quarks show up wherever we look for them. Maybe this has a lot to do with how people show up, the way we're looking for them. Are we looking for them to be jerks? Are we looking for them to be incredibly powerful and have an influence on their lives? Then we have strings. And strings are really interesting. The theory of strings is kind of like if I were to sit here and I were to play a cello, strum a cello, you would hear sound no matter where you were in the room. Now, strings are actually kind of like the things that create quarks. And they call them strings because they're little vibrating strings of data, or actually little vibrating strings of energy. And they make up these quarks, so they coagulate into quarks. Here's what's fascinating. What we know about strings is that they seem to show up all over the place around things that exist. So in this sense, the universe appears to be creating itself with strings because everything's vibrating. We know that molecules vibrate and atoms vibrate and electrons, neutrons, and protons vibrate. But we also know that strings are the result of vibration. It's really fascinating stuff. So now, let's take a look at another model that has to do with our brain. We know that in our brain we have these synapses. And these synapses that we have in our brain include neurons, dendritic connections, axonal connections. And these basic dendrites are kind of like a hairy octopus, or these synapses are kind of like a hairy octopus. And they're connected with nerves between each other. They're all connected with nerves with these arms that are dendritic, and they connect to each other. And what we know is that when you have memories or habits, what's actually happening is where a dendrite is connecting to another one, and it's forming a neural pattern in your brain. Napoleon Hill wrote a book in the 1920s called Think and Grow Rich. And here was his conclusion. He talked to some of the most successful, most powerful people on the planet. His conclusion was, you become what you think about. Rich people are always thinking about making money. Famous people are always thinking about how can I become more famous? What is it that you're always thinking about? Because whatever it is, that's what you're ending up with. And what we see about these quarks, these synapses that we have in our head, is that they are connected with these nerves. Now, science has proven recently that the vibration in the nerve connecting the synapse is actually what we experience as consciousness. So that a person who's unconscious, the nerves in their brain aren't vibrating. They're little nerve fibers, kind of like a cello string, only they're white and they're kind of a biochemical wire, and they vibrate. And the faster they vibrate, the more awake and the more alive we are. We would hypothesize that in an enlightened human being, these would be vibrating at a very fast rate. And for somebody that's in a coma, they're hardly vibrating at all. What we know is that when a person dies, when they go brain dead, even though their heart may still be pumping, those nerves stop vibrating. That's what brain death is. Now, let's see how we can connect these. We know that we have molecules, electrons, protons, neutrons, quarks, and strings, and they're made of energy that comes from vibrations. And we know that our brain is a very highly evolved neural net that's constantly putting out alpha, beta, gamma waves, and a whole variety of other signals that come from those nerves vibrating. Just like Einstein proved in his formula E equals mc squared, he basically proved that all matter was made of energy. If in the next few years we can prove that the vibration that's given off by our brain is actually creating strings, we can actually prove so many of the principles of quantum physics that say we are actually creating the world that we live in. Coaches have been doing this for years. People that work in business, people that work with clients. I myself have had clients that are Academy Award winners and Olympic gold medalists. And when I work with super achievers like this, what I find is that they are so one-pointed on what they really want that their neural net is focused in such a way that they literally create a force field around them, attracting magnetically what they really want. And there are serendipitous, crazy things that happen. Coincidences that you couldn't possibly create, you know, in a laboratory, just because they're so focused and intense on what they really want. So, what are you thinking about? Because whatever you're most thinking about, that's probably what you're ending up with. Let's talk a little bit about fear and excitement. We have an experience called fear. Now, imagine two people that jump off a bridge with a bungee cord tied around their ankles. One of them goes, "Ah!" The other one goes, "Wee!" Are they having the same experience? Two people that jump off a bridge with a bungee cord tied around their ankles, one is terrified and the other one is excited. But they're having the exact same experience. So what's the difference? What is really the difference between fear and excitement? Is there really a tangible difference, or is it just our interpretation? Is it true that the things you fear are actually, you're afraid of them and you stay away from them because they're harmful? Or do you stay away from them because the fact is you're terrified that you're going to become more powerful? You've heard of the fear of success. Do you know what the top three greatest human fears are? A lot of studies have been done about this. If you go out on the street and you ask 100 people, what are your top three greatest fears, and you make a list, the number one greatest human fear is public speaking. Number two greatest human fear is peer rejection. And the number three greatest human fear is untimely death. Now let me ask a question. Have you ever seen anyone die at the microphone? Have a limb sheared off? Be tortured at the microphone of some painful death? Of course not. So the fear of public speaking is not actually a fear of something dangerous. It's a fear of something exciting. So let's take a look at this from a different angle. My greatest fear is actually the fear of excitement. Or, as Marianne Williamson put it, our greatest fear is not that we are weak. Our greatest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, handsome, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God, and your playing small does not serve the world. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't be insecure around you. You were born to make manifest the glory of God within you. It is not just in some, it is in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we subconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our fear, we unconsciously liberate others. What this is really about is that the great fears that we have And we're projecting out that they're actually excitement, or we're projecting out that their fears are actually excitements. Now, I want to make a specific caveat here. I never ask people to do anything dangerous. In other words, there are dangers, things like bungee jumping, things like skydiving, things like cliff diving. And those are things that I encourage people to stay away from because they are dangerous. But public speaking isn't dangerous. Frankly, neither is peer rejection. So, now we know that our greatest fear is not that we're weak. Our greatest fear is that we're powerful beyond measure. And if we're facing our fears, if we're day by day going at them, then we can know that we're becoming more powerful, that we're answering that call of evolution to evolve, to take what's most meaningful to us, to fill the sphere of our sphere of influence in our lives with what's most meaningful to us, and become a force of nature. Thank you for watching, and we'll see you in part two of Life Camp, Quantum Physics for Creating an Amazing Life. Have a great day.